The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Colombia.
It's that time of the week again, folks. It's me, your host, Richard McCall, here in Mompós, Bolívar. It's 37 degrees here. I'm sweating a little bit, but it makes a nice break from being in rainy Bogota and not at 2,600 meters above sea level. We're about 10 meters above sea level. But this is episode 236 of Columbia Calling, and I'm very happy to have repeat guest and important journalist here in Columbia on the show, on the line from Medellin. Those of you who know anything about Columbia will know that the site to read, to look at, and the number one site on all search engines for Columbia is Columbia Reports. That's ColumbiaReports.com. So we've got the director of Columbia Reports, Adrian Alselma, on the line from Medellin, and we're very appreciative that he's here talking to us again, but also appreciative that he's back in Columbia. Adrian, you're back from Holland. How's Medellin treating you?
Pretty good so far. Yeah. I haven't been picked up by any Uri Vista yet.
Oh, well, that'll happen sooner or later, surely. I mean, let's not dwell on that to begin with, but that I'm sure that's in someone's diary. But you were away for a bit, you're back, you're at the helm of Columbia Reports again. Let's talk about this. At the moment, you are being shadowed by a photographer from Dutch Esquire magazine.
Yeah.
Now, this guy is following you around, taking photographs for a feature on you. So you're basically like the Hunter S. Thompson for the Dutch community. They picture you over here in Colombia in a crazy way, I imagine.
Which wouldn't be entirely inaccurate.
Uh-huh.
I don't suppose I'm the average foreign correspondent.
Well, no, there's nothing average, certainly, about you. I mean, I've known you, we've sat down and chatted, we talk about the issues in Colombia, but, I mean, how did they approached you and said you are this kind of guy that has a cult following in Medellin and in Colombia, we want to do a feature on you?
Yeah.
That's it. So that the news writer becomes the news.
Yeah, which is very embarrassing.
So, have you changed your
bit? If you're ugly like me,
But this is the great thing about Photoshop these days. They can make you look like a cross between Alec Baldwin and Leonardo DiCaprio. You know, you can be okay.
If they can make my breasts bigger, that would be great.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah, straying into weird peccadilloes, sexual peccadilloes there, Adrian. But listen, so, I mean, what are you showing this reporter? How are you introducing them to Medellin and your life?
Well, he's actually staying with me for a week. And he's just like annoyingly following me around. So like whenever I light up a doobie, it's like snap.
So it's like having a pesky little brother there.
And then when I'm like scratching my bottom while sitting on my desk, it's like snap. it's got to be one of those articles.
Perhaps you should think about these things before you pick your nose or something. Yeah, definitely. And it's like I was saying, it's like having a pesky little brother there, I guess.
Yeah, or a very intense girlfriend.
Or a very intense girlfriend. Now, so, okay, so this guy's following you around, he's walking everywhere, he's staying with you. I mean, there's absolutely no privacy whatsoever. And, I mean, it's kind of like method acting. You are completely immersed in the reality of having a photographer there in your life. I mean, you're basically being, you're under the threat of continual paparazzi.
I'm going to be famous.
You're going to be famous, but you're already famous. You're in the cult circles. I mean, we know that. Everybody in Colombia knows who you are as well. But let's get down to the crux of things. I mean, you've got this guy there. Your life's being photographed. Well, let's say you're back in Colombia. You're an outspoken critic of, let's say, a very famous Antioqueño, the former president. His party and his people are getting into power on August 7th. I mean, they've been in power for a while, really, if you technically speaking, or non-technically speaking. But I mean, let's ensure that this article that comes out is not your eulogy, please.
Well, that wouldn't be up to me.
Yeah.
That's kind of up to Colombian authorities. Like, the problem in Colombia at the moment is that nobody is protected from anything.
Mm. And I guess,
And obviously that affects me, well, unfortunately, much less than it affects locals, because because I'm a gringo, I got special status, and the Dutch embassy is very, very fanatic about freedom of speech. The exposure isn't always good.
I mean, I'm sure they know where you live, your movements, your friends. I mean, who are we talking about who are possibly... let's say, out to get you.
I don't believe anyone's out to get me.
Good.
I'm just unprotected.
Yeah, this is true. Yeah.
I'm unprotected. Mm. Like anyone in Colombia who is critical of any authority, unfortunately.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, we've had a contentious election period. It's the actual voting.
Best elections ever, if you ask me.
Yeah, I mean, it's been great on the one side, and listeners will understand, listeners who will understand what I'm saying, is that actually, we genuinely, it was as if Colombia matured in this electoral period, but the outcome was, predictably, I would say we could have predicted it, but it's not going to be great for the freedom of the press.
No, not at all.
Not at all. I mean, and so that puts you right in the middle of the, you know, let's say, I mean, puts a target on your back, let's say, but you do get, I mean, we as foreigners do have a certain degree of protection. Of course, we get the gringo element, but local journalists, national journalists, and journalists in sort of, let's say, small towns around the country, if they reveal anything untoward, they are really a threat.
The thing is, because this has been a structural issue for so long, many, many journalists have stopped speaking out or reporting on the truth years ago already.
Yeah.
And if you look at the countryside, especially where you are, like in Bolivar, or even worse, in the south of the country, where the state is just barely present, many, many towns don't have local radio stations, or the local journalists are just smart enough not to say anything that could upset anyone. So So people are just not being warned because this structural threat posed against journalism and journalists in particular, and especially local journalists who are most vulnerable.
Mm. Yeah, no, it's a...
And the effects are terrible because the effect is that people simply do not know their own country, or the knowledge of their own country has been trivialized. Like people will know more about Jessica Sedil's ass than that their own military is close to being extradited to the Netherlands to be put on trial for killing thousands of civilians.
Mm.
It's disgraceful, and it's tragic because there are many important stories to be told in Colombia, and they are not being told because people are afraid.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if we talk about my own personal experience, you know, I'm really not on the front line. I'm a very lightweight journalist in terms of all of this sort of stuff, but having a family, having a little boy and so on, I am very aware about what to report on and what not to do so. And I'm not Colombian. As I said, I'm shielded by the gringo card, but just put yourself into a situation where it's a Colombian with a family. I mean, you know, think about the reality.
Well, yeah, the family, like, I don't have a family. Well, I have my mom who is worried sick about me.
Mm.
But if I had a child, I wouldn't be writing what I'm writing now.
Right.
Because I would find that irresponsible as a parent.
Yeah.
And that fact is just that must change. Like, this is like, we cannot have a democracy if we cannot guarantee the freedom of speech.
That's
and,
it.
And what's very important in Colombia is that, like, often criticism, and this is part of, like, Colombian culture and part of the political culture, where criticism is often seen as insurgency rather than, like, just criticism. So people who are critical, for example, of Duque or Uribe or whichever authoritarian prick is in power, I lost my train of thought.
That's all right, but I understand. It's the stigma. It's the stigma after these, let's say, 50-odd years of, let's say, leftist insurgency, if we use the best,
I caught my train of thought. So criticism is confused with insurgency, and criticism is seen as if, like, people who are critical of authority want to abolish the authority rather than strengthen authority, if you know what I mean. Like journalism is an integrated part of democracy. Like, you cannot have a democracy without, like, civilian oversight of what's happening in power and what the people in power are doing. If we cannot speak openly on issues like corruption or ties to illegal armed groups, then we cannot sustain a democracy. And that's, like, what's happening in Colombia, and that's what's always happened in Colombia.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It could even be part of why the armed conflict even began, because what the election so interestingly shown was that beneath the armed conflict, which was between armed groups, the FARC specifically, and the military, underneath lies a social conflict where minorities are being repressed undemocratically, where critics are being silenced. So the people who are supportive of the state system and want to contribute to it they are either killed or silenced otherwise. And that forces some of them to take up arms, because that is apparently the only way that people listen to you. And this is very, this is a very dangerous thing at the moment. If you look at the social leaders that are getting killed in Colombia, according to the ombudsman, 311 social leaders have been killed since January 1, 2016. Like, at one point, people are going to be asking themselves, like, should I get myself a gun?
Mm.
You know what I mean? And then we're back in 1964.
It's a really, it's an unspeakable situation, what is going on in Colombia at the moment. I would venture that it's not different to what has happened in the past. Of course, it's very similar, but perhaps we are more aware of what this systematic elimination, eradication of anyone who's speaking out or protecting groups' rights and so on, because we have a certain degree of transparency since the, let's say, the formal side of the FARC demobilized and signed a peace accord. Maybe because that has happened, we are seeing this dreadful situation of, as you say, 311. That's the official figure, 311 deaths, assassinations since January the 1st, 2016. I mean, I assume this was happening before, but maybe we're seeing it now. But this is a country that's supposedly turning the page.
It was happening before, but most of the violence that was employed was targeting the FARC directly. Mm. And now that the FARC is gone, so now that the insurgency, like the actual insurgency, is gone, the violence targeting critics has considerably increased. Like we are talking about, like, on a yearly basis, like three times as many homicides as during the conflict. So, and what worries me the most is that, like, this happened in the 1980s too with the Unión Patriótica party. And this particular extermination of that political party led to a radicalization within Colombia and particularly, like, within the FARC, and basically triggered one of the most violent periods in the armed conflict. And that extermination was also following a peace accord in 1985.
Yeah.
So the risk that the country is taking now is another escalation of violence similar to that of the 1990s, which is a period that nobody wants to remember, because it was just incredibly violent. Like, if like there's only so much, like critics can take before some are like, ah, fuck this.
Mm.
We're taking up arms, and like it's seriously crossed my mind that maybe I should get a gun out of self-protection, but which many Americans would probably find a logical thought, like, yeah go get a gun, but in Colombia, in the Colombian context, this is kind of scary.
Mm.
And what you don't want to do, like we were just able to get like 9,000 guns out of the country, and reducing the homicide rate to the lowest point since they started counting a homicide rate, and that's kind of like what we all want, I suppose. Like we want to live in a country where we can just be citizens without running fiscal risks.
Yeah, it's a very worrying situation, and one that is not being, I mean, there's a specialist press that's reporting it, but it's not getting the oxygen it needs to
No, there's no, because there's no big explosions, because there's no presidential candidate. It's a sort of slow burning violence that's going on. But if you look at the numbers, like we are talking about, like a political extermination campaign, that's possibly more intense than the one that happened in the 1980s with the Unión Patriótica, and that should really concern us, because like we've seen this before, we've seen the consequences before, and there is no indication that anybody is willing to take action to prevent a resurgence of violence, which would be a total disaster. Like this country has had so much violence over nothing. Like the violence that we've seen in Colombia is an escalation of the same political division that you would see in the United States, or that you see in the United Kingdom, or in my country, the Netherlands. It's just that here it escalated to the point where people were killing each other, which is still going on.
Mm. Well,
we wouldn't want that to escalate again. Like we must like collectively take action that this doesn't escalate to another war again.
It's true. It's true. It's, as I say, a worrying situation. Let's take unfortunately, let's break this and take a short break and come back and address this issue a bit more, because it's something that needs to be broadcast. It needs to be shared. It needs to be understood by people out there, Colombians, foreigners, and so on, that this is taking place. It's a genocide that is taking place at presently. But we are talking to Adrian Alsalma, who's in Medellin at the moment. I'm in Mompox, Bolivar. This is Colombia Calling, episode 236. We'll take a short break and be right back talking about this worrying situation taking place in Colombia. Thank you for listening. Don't go away. And we're back. This is Colombia Calling, episode 236. So you'll know we're talking to Adrian Alsalma, the director of Colombia Reports out there in Medellin, Colombia. I'm in Mompox, Bolivar. We're talking about this dreadful situation that's going on in the Colombia, a systematic genocide of anyone who's protecting, let's say, the rights of the few, or the many, let's say, in Colombia. There's been the official figures are more than 311 deaths, assassinations since January the 1st, 2016, of social leaders, community leaders, people from the LGBTQ community and more. Adrian, I mean, you've been talking about this situation. As a journalist with the desire to want to write a story about this, and obviously the actual fear that I have for myself, but of course I should, you know, as a journalist, put that fear aside. But at the same time, I want to know who's doing this. Let's put it into a hypothetical situation and not get ourselves in trouble here. Let's say that, okay, you know, the members of the armed forces, the Fuerza Pública, so the police, or armed groups, or dissident guerrillas, or guerrilla groups, they're behind these things. But then at the end of it, what do they stand to gain?
Well, it's very important to realize that much of the country is lawless. So after the demobilization of the FARC, and I don't think that people realize that when the FARC were still in arms, they were the actual government in parts that were under their control. They repaired the roads, they imposed justice, they made sure that fights were being calmed down, and etc., etc. Mm-hmm. When they went away and the government didn't move in, other forces took power. And this is not just illegal armed groups. You're also talking about wealthy landowners, for example, who have traditionally enjoyed great economical and political power in remote regions. Hmm. And in some areas are maintaining a sort of a feudal system where they are basically the lord, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So in some cases, you're dealing a very important part of the, well, I think that upsets me a lot about social leaders being killed is the leaders of victims' rights and usually, well, not usually, but too often, these leaders are trying to get land back that was stolen by wealthy landowners during the war, and they are now getting killed basically to prevent them from getting their rightful property back. And so it's not just the ELN that's doing the killing or the AGC that's doing the killing. It's very varied. So you got the ELN doing some of the killing, you got the AGC doing other parts of the killing, then you got these regional lords doing other parts of the killing, and it's all happening in an environment where the state is failing. Like where the state is not able to simply put up a police post or maintain a normal municipal administration and exercise the state power that's required of any entity that wishes to call itself the state. And as a consequence of this power vacuum, you got all types of forces that are taking control, and they are not respecting the life of anyone. They'll just kill you if you're in their way, and that's what's going on. And it's not just illegal armed groups or terrorist groups, as people love to call them. It's also businesses. It's security companies. It's become a kind of like a way of maintaining order.
It's terrifying. And now, but so if we talk the ELN, the national...
It's so incredibly terrifying.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think people abroad have any idea what it's like having to live with the fear that, like, if you defend your right, for example, to keep your own property, to keep your land, that can actually get you killed. Or that the minute somebody challenges your property, that you could potentially get killed. The systematic and structural intimidation that we must live with is horrifying. It's terrible.
Mm.
And it must, it may not continue. It must stop. The state must take control of the country.
If we say that the ELN, the National Liberation Army, involved in on again, off again, peace talks forever, now in Cuba, and I guess those dialogues will end up being cancelled by the new regime coming in, we say that they are, you know, let's in charge or charging money or, you know, executing people in areas where there's illegal mining and legal mining and coca fields. So that's one side, and then the AGC, and what?
And cattle ranching,
and the AGC, so the Auto Defensas Gaitanistas de Colombia, supposedly, I guess, a right-wing group, but really just a gang, they would be in the same areas as well, so it's economic interests. And then you, like you mentioned, these regional lords, or we could just say the feudal landowners, that can date back to whenever, they sort of sweep up the killings under the carpet of like the blanket guilt of the groups to say, oh, this must be an armed gang, this must be a guerrilla group. But so how can we call upon a government to get involved and to stop this from happening? I mean, is it as simple as just more state presence in the regions? Or, I mean, there's something fundamentally wrong in society that this is taking place with so much impunity.
Correct. Mm. This is entirely about the state not being in control of the country and not carrying out its duties as a state. Like I depend on the police for my safety if I walk on the street, just like the next guy. Mm. If the police just simply doesn't do anything, that makes me vulnerable. And this is happening in large parts of Colombia. This is what you see in the poor parts of the Colombian cities, like Bogota and Medellin and Cali. And it's what you see in much of the countryside, where the state simply hasn't established any presence. Like if you call the police, they don't answer. If you call the mayor's office, they don't answer. Like they just don't exist. They take the tax money. They just don't provide the public services that you would expect of a state. And in Colombia, this neglect has deteriorated to the point that things have just gotten extremely violent.
Yeah.
And this is so. A structural solution would be for the state to effectively move in to take responsibility for public security, for public well-being in remote areas and in poor areas. Mm. Because there seems to be a sort of a classist or an elitist element too, where if you're in the north of Bogota or in the south of Medellin, which are the rich parts of town, then you can count on the police. But I had a friend who lives in the poor part of Medellin, and her daughter got raped. And she called the police, and they just never showed up. And we're talking about the rape of a little girl, mm-hmm. and the police doesn't even show up. Well, at that point, people are going to be using all kinds of methods to get justice, and this is like this is extremely dangerous.
Yeah.
This is why. People invented a state in the first place to prevent this type of excesses.
If we look at the map, and I've got the sort of map open from the ombudsman and the different numbers, unfortunately, numbers of these social leaders and community leaders and so on being assassinated, the regions of Cauca, more than 70, and Antioquia, more than 30, are the two sort of most rife departments in Colombia where this is taking place. I mean, these are traditionally troublesome areas in terms, but it's this strategic corridor, really, isn't it? If we look at Cauca and Antioquia, I mean, these are rich regions and politically important regions. But why these areas, would you say, are the most violent at this moment?
Well, both regions are also have a very far right elite, mm. And have a very troublesome, troubled economic profiles. So Cauca, for example, is where the sugar plantations are, and the sugar plantation owners have a conflict with the local indigenous groups over land theft. In Antioquia, there's a lot of gold. Mm. In Cauca, there's a lot of gold too. So the conflict in Antioquia, for example, is a lot about like having control over the gold mines. In Cauca, there's a mix of conflict where it is about gold. And it's about the conflict between the indigenous communities and the sugar industry, and it's really like in neither province an illegal armed group is necessarily involved in the conflict.
Mm.
Like they could be employed, But the conflict is something social, and is something that has to do with the economic situation in that part of the country.
It's worrying, and I do think it's only going to increase this systematic killing that's going on. That adds this horrible phrase that people use.
What we must, and that's what I, as a journalist, I that's really what I hope to do, is that I want, like, the government to acknowledge that they've been negligent. And that they must take responsibility for the basic duties of government, which is just providing basic police services, providing water, and helping, and also like an effective justice system that helps solving disputes in court rather than at the point of a gun.
Yeah. Of course. Now, I have in my belongings some of the pamphlets that have been distributed in various parts of Colombia, and especially here in Mompox. You know, revolting, chilling pamphlets. You know, paper, photocopies, piece of paper with lists of people's names and so on. When they say that they're going to do the limpieza social, which is this most dreadful term, the social cleansing, which is basically just settling scores. People who you can pay.
It's maintaining a fascist order, like a social cleansing. Like, that means that there's like a determination of people who are undesirable, and undesirable could mean anything. It could mean you're a Jew. It could mean you're gay. It could mean you have long hair. It could mean that you have political preferences that are opposite to those who employ violence. This social cleansing is a fascist phenomenon, and is part of the social order in many parts of Colombia.
I worry very much about this reality, and you know, and people talk about it openly as well. If you've got problems, you know, people will say, you know, vamos a mandar la moto. And that's a reference to it, isn't it? The reference is that we'll just get them knocked off. I mean, as if it was as simple as that. I mean, I don't know. I don't know what to do. I mean, I end up talking about this a lot on TV shows, radio shows, writing about it, saying, you know, it's about state, effective state presence and basic rights such as, you know, water, education, getting your cultivations to road. If you're a smallholder farmer, you just want to sell your goods.
Because if you look at the worst conflict areas, take Chocó for example, they've been building a road between the capital of Chocó, Quibdó, and Medellín. For more than 30 years, people have been paying taxes to build a road, and for 30 years, that money has just systematically been stolen. And that's the level of sort of like this government we are dealing with, and I believe like. I've been very annoyed during the elections about the whole debate about left and right, which I thought was very distorting for what the actual problem is in Colombia. Like we need to be talking about like that we want an actual effective government, that when we pay taxes, that we get our public services in return, so that if we pay taxes, then we get a road, or a hospital, you know, that type of stuff. And there's nothing leftist about wanting your money's back when you pay taxes.
That's it, isn't it?
It's not that anybody wants like a big state or a socialist state. We just want the state, period.
Yeah, I think that's it, isn't it? But I think it's not even just those of us, the few of us who pay taxes. Please, can you start charging taxes on the people who don't pay the taxes? Please, can you start a return on that?
Well, that's an entirely different thing. If you look at tax evasion, for example, this is a far bigger problem than, for example, corruption.
Mm.
The Panama Papers revealed that approximately a quarter of the country's GDP, is hidden in tax havens abroad. Like the tax evasion is costing billions and billions and billions a year.
Yeah.
And this makes it impossible to run a state because people don't pay their taxes. And also, if you go into the cities, like any of the neighborhood shops, for example, they don't pay taxes. They don't pay sales tax.
Mm.
Or pay like a business tax for running a shop. Like literally nobody pays taxes, and until we pay taxes, the state can't afford government. Mm. If you know what I mean. Like they need the financing to run a government. Yes. So the problem of tax evasion plus the problem of corruption is just making the Colombian government a farce.
Mm.
Or the Colombian state a farce.
Ineffective beyond most areas. Yeah. Ineffective in the cities itself, but ineffective beyond urban Colombia as well. I mean, that's it, isn't it? Rural Colombia is left behind.
Rural Colombia is anarchy, period.
Hmm. I was thinking about this as I was driving from Valledupar yesterday to Mompós, and we just had the census pass by us in Bogotá, and you know, I live in a nice part of Bogotá, and the girl comes in and starts asking the questions. And you know, she asks after our education, asks how many people live in our apartment, the strato, of course, and so on. And then, you know, I was talking about this yesterday with my wife in the vehicle, and we were saying the last time that they did the census, they would ask, you know, they would do things like ask what kind of floors you have, mud floors or wooden floors or cement floors and so on. And we're driving through these areas of Colombia, rural Colombia, where I would say 98% of all of that what we passed was dirt floors, and yet this huge chasm, this divide between urban and rural haves and haves nots, and this has to be closed. I mean, I don't expect it to be, you know, the whole equal society, but something has to give. Something has to be improved for these areas.
That's a bit of the problem, because like what you're proposing is an increased level of what a lot of people would call socialism.
Yeah.
Although I would call it, it's like a normal society, like a functioning society. The different, like the problem isn't so much that some people are very rich, like God bless them. But the problem is that so many people are just so dirt poor.
Mm.
Like here in Medellin, for example, like many of my female friends are unemployed. Those who have children are more often than not forced into prostitution just to feed their children.
Mm.
The guys are recruited by gangs. Because first of all, they got nothing to do. And second of all, they have no opportunity to move forward other than through a gang. It's the only way for them to make money and to provide for their family. And so if we talk about like, you know, we need to close this wealth gap. That doesn't mean that we want like a socialist state where everybody is equally rich. It only means that we must reduce the poverty and increase people's the number of opportunities for people, so that people do not have to resort to crime or prostitution or other behavior that we probably all agree on are very unhealthy elements of a society.
Yeah, it's the truth. Unfortunately, there's just not enough time to talk about all these issues, and I know that that Adrian could keep us informed for hours, but what you're doing, reporting there from Medellin on ColombiaReports.com, is incredibly important for Colombia, for the country, for the international news, and for the freedom of speech. And please don't get yourself in trouble. Please don't run too many risks. Colombia Reports, we rely on this website for up-to-date, factually correct, and, you know, let's say, stuff that's not being reported elsewhere. And Colombia Reports is reader, is paid for by the readers, you know, just by donations only. It's so if you go to the website, www.columbiareports.com, throw some cash at it. It's only $5 a month or something for a subscription. Isn't that right, Adrian?
Correct.
Yeah.
If you go to the website and do /friend, then it'll show itself.
It's true.
And yes, please, the work we are doing is not done out of itself. It costs money. So if anyone wants to support what we are doing, please help us out.
Yeah, and so important stuff. And as I said earlier, Adrian is being shadowed at the moment by a photographer for Esquire magazine in Holland, because he is a cult figure. He is something of a legend in Colombia amongst all of us. Perhaps the Hunter S. Thompson, to flatter him there, of journalism, foreign journalists in Colombia. Maybe Gonzo, maybe not Gonzo, maybe just too much on point. So let me just take this moment to say thank you to Adrian for sharing these indispensable opinions with us about what's going on in Colombia. And of course, please stay safe, Adrian.
I will. Thank you so much for talking to me.
No, not at all. Not at all. It's always a pleasure and great to have you back in the country and reporting again. So this has been episode 236 of Colombia Calling, dealing with some very important issues, unreported issues about Colombia. Hey, you know, we do mix up the episodes here on Colombia Calling because it's to give a slice of the reality here in Colombia. See if it's good, if it's bad, if it's mediocre, we'll report on it. But this is Colombia Calling. So I've been Richard McCall. This is Colombia Calling, episode 236, talking to Adrian Alsama of Colombia Reports. Thank you again for listening. We'll be back next week with more information and stories from Colombia. Bye-bye.